Welcome to VAT and Property in 2021. Before I introduce us, I just wanted to note that this is being filmed on the 27th of October, which is budget day, and it doesn't reflect any announcements today and so should be viewed as up to date as of the 26th. I'm Tracy Wright. I'm a partner at Osborne Clark.
And I'm Alex Makinson. I'm a senior associate at Osborne Clark as well.
So what are the topics that we're going to cover today? We're going to have a look at the Revenue and Customs Brief 12 2020 to do with VAT on early termination fees and compensation payments. We'll look at the VAT exemption, the domestic reverse charge, importantly, sale and leasebacks, and just finish up with a recent care home case. So I'm going to kick off looking at VAT on early termination fees and the Revenue and Customs Brief from 2020. So this was a brief in September 2020, and it introduced some changes to existing guidance. And it was in relation to the VAT on termination fees and compensation payments. Now, whilst it was issued over a year ago, we're still on a journey in relation to it. So first, I think it's worth taking stock on the timeline of events. So the brief itself was prompted by two telecoms cases. Now, when it was issued, it wasn't stated as specific to the telecom sector or to real estate or to any sector. So it was viewed and does have wider application. That then created lots of questions in relation to its application outside of the telecom sector, particularly for this webinar in relation to real estate. Now, what was clear was that the Revenue hadn't necessarily considered the wider application when they issued the brief. Importantly, when it was issued, it also had retrospective application, with the Revenue expecting people to look back on transactions over the last 4 years and to amend any transactions that didn't have a VAT treatment in line with the brief. Understandably, that created a bit of hoo-ha in the industry and led to industry groups raising concerns with HMRC. And at the end of December, early January 2021, the Revenue accepted that they had sought advice and managed to find a position where it didn't have retrospective impact after all. They acknowledged that they needed to reflect on the guidance that was published and does sit in the manuals and its wider application outside of the telecoms issues that the cases had raised in the first place. And they said that until the guidance was updated, that taxpayers could rely on the law before the Revenue and Customs Brief, or they could rely on the guidance as stated. But importantly, that guidance is due to be updated. So the choice of relying on the guidance as it stands at the moment is the guidance that's really in a state of flux. Now, that messaging from the Revenue is on the Revenue website, but it's on the landing page for the brief. It's not in the actual brief itself. So if you just go straight into Revenue and Customs Brief, you won't see that, and you'll just think that the Revenue and Customs Brief operates as it was originally issued. So you need to go to the landing page to find that additional explanation. So we still haven't got revised guidance, but we know that an August draft was sent to the Joint VAT Consultative Committee for further consideration, albeit there are no minutes of that meeting as yet.
Thanks, Tracy. That's interesting. You mentioned that there is movement on the revised guidance. Do you think we might see something as part of the package of publications or measures as part of today's budget?
Thanks, Alex. Possibly. It's all a timing thing. None of this process is linked to the budget. But as we know, there are always announcements that come out after the budget. I suspect we will get something before the end of the year, but that's only my hunch. Whether it will come as part of budget measures, I'm not sure there's necessarily a motivation to do so, but that's only my view. But we'll wait and see, I suspect. So shall I move on to the next slide then and just look at what actually the brief was about? So the overriding concept was about when a termination payment or compensation is actually payment for a supply for VAT purposes. And what the Revenue said in the updated guidance was whether a payment is for a VAT supply depends on whether anything is done in return for consideration, which is what we would expect. Where a party agrees to do something in return for a fee, there is a supply. But importantly, they said how that fee is described does not affect whether there is a supply for VAT. What matters is that something is done and there is a direct link between what is done and the payment received. So what they were saying was just because something is described as compensation, if it is directly linked to what has been done, then that will be a supply and it will be a taxable supply for VAT, and the tax treatment will follow the underlying supply. So in the telecoms cases, the payments were for early termination of the telecoms contract, and it was viewed as those payments weren't compensatory. They related to the supply of the telephones in the first place, and it was that the payment to get out of the contract related to that earlier contract for the supply. Now that makes sense in the context of the cases, but in the real estate world, there was concern as to how that and the wider updates to the guidance apply to some of the things we come across from the property side. So I'm just going to touch on three areas that were discussed at the time to highlight the things you need to think about now and where we are at the moment. So the first one is break payments. Now, before the Revenue and Customs brief was issued, we knew that if you had a break payment in a lease, so the right to break the term of a lease on payment of a sum of money, if it was written into the lease, then payment of that break fee was typically viewed as outside the scope of VAT. Now, there could be a discussion as to whether or not that was the right treatment, but that was the settled view of the revenue and was well known in the industry. If there was no such right in the lease and the parties just agreed a surrender, an early surrender of the lease, then the payment would be a reverse surrender and it would be a supply by the landlord. The tenant would be paying and it would be exempt subject to the landlord's option to tax. That was the old position. Now, because of the revised guidance and the guidance that you'll see in the VAT Supply Consideration Manual 5920, it talks about early termination payments being a supply, whether or not it's stated in the contract or by later agreement. And by implication, that means that it doesn't matter now if you state the break fee in the lease or you agree it outside of the lease. So the expectation is that break fees will now all be viewed as supplies, and then the supply will follow the underlying rent under the lease, and it will be whether it will be exempt subject to the landlord's options to tax. Now, we need to wait for the updated guidance, but I'm not expecting that to change. But in a way, that's clearer because there is no difference then between a fee in a lease or outside. We then look at dilapidations. Now, dilapidations payments are paid when a lease comes to an end. Typically, a lease will have a yielding up provision. It will expect the property to be delivered back to the landlord in an agreed state of repair. Now, if it isn't delivered in that way, often the landlord will agree to the tenant that they, instead of delivering it up in the way it should be delivered up, they will pay a monetary sum as compensation for not delivering it up in the way that they should have done. And that's always been viewed as compensation for not doing what you should have done it under the lease. Now, again, the treatment of that was in doubt as a result to the revised guidance, and also through some discussions with the revenue in that sort of December, January 2021 window when industry was talking to the revenue. And there was an indication from the revenue that they felt that dilapidations payments may be viewed as supplies. But that was at the time felt that was because the revenue referred to dilapidations fees and whether they were misunderstanding how the payments were actually derived in practice and whether they were expecting actually leases to provide for a fee to be paid, whereas typically it doesn't. Typically a lease will just expect the property to be delivered up at the end of the term, and the compensation payment is an agreement for the cost to deliver it up. It isn't written into the lease in the first place. Now, we need to wait to see where we get to with dilapidations payments once the revised guidance does come out. But as far as I understand, from what I know has been being discussed, there is a greater understanding of how dilapidations payments work. And those where it is a genuinely compensatory payment for not delivering up the building in the way they should, it, it, we think that we're going to end up with dilapidations payments sitting outside of the lease unless there is a specific fee provided for in it. So it's watch this space at the moment, but that's where we think we're going to end up. And finally, liquidated damages. There was in the updated guidance in the VAT Supply and Consideration Manual 5930, there was reference to liquidated damages and the payment for liquidated damages being a supply. And that didn't sit well in the context of liquidated damages in the construction industry, where we would come across them from a property perspective, because typically they're paid by the supplier. So you might have your building contractor who has an obligation to pay liquidated damages for late delivery of the construction of a building. So if it doesn't reach practical completion at the time agreed. Now, it seems to be that the reference to liquidated damages in the guidance is more looking at when a customer pays such damages. And the understanding at the moment is that liquidated damages may be viewed as actually a discount to the price and really should be an adjustment to the price such that a credit note is issued by the supplier. So if you think they've been paid for their works and then they're asked to pay liquidated damages, they're effectively being treated, or one view is that they're being treated as the money being paid back. And so a credit note should be issued for the money that passes back. Now, I think that works in some situations, but in other situations, that payment is genuinely compensatory. It isn't through a discount on the delivery of the work because something has been done incorrectly in relation to the work. It is the consequential loss of, for example, late delivery. And it may well be that in that situation, it is still seen as purely compensatory and outside the scope. But either way, a credit note or outside the scope, what we're not seeing is that the actual payment itself is a supply. And that makes sense because it's going in the wrong direction. So with all of these, some of these are just my view, where we think we're going to end up. At the moment, we're in a position where we have the right to apply the old rules or the guidance as it stands at the moment, and we're waiting for new guidance to be updated. So in practice, the advice is to have more caution in relation to VAT clauses in contracts that could be affected by this guidance. Typically, you want to ensure that you have the right to charge VAT if that is going to be the case down the line. And so VAT clauses should be VAT exclusive. You may also want to have the right to revise your invoicing if for any reason the parties get it wrong and you need to regularise it. Be particularly careful in relation to payments that may come down the line when the new guidance actually does apply, because once it's out, the expectation is that that will be the revenues view, and that choice as to which view you apply will fall away.
Thanks, Tracy. I just wondered whether in practice you're seeing more people still following the old position or adopting the position as set out in the business brief.
Yeah, it's a good question, Alex. I think it depends on the timings of the contract. So, for example, with dilapidations payments, where you're agreeing them and they're going to be paid, you know, shortly after they're agreed, I think typically people are still viewing them as compensation. They're comfortable that the new guidance hasn't been revised. They're comfortable with where they think it's going to end up anyway. And because of the timings, they will agree the payments, typically based on it still being compensation. Break fees are a different one. There's always caution with relation to break fees, because if you don't pay the right amount of money, you may not have a valid break from a property law perspective. So there's far more caution on break fees. And typically I would expect people to expect to pay VAT on a break fee, or certainly providing the contract that VAT will be charged. Now, what you might do is then have further mechanics in the contract that say, to the extent that we've offered you up VAT to get our break and it turns out that VAT isn't due, then we need some mechanics to get it back. But there's much more caution about break fees than there used to be.
Thanks, Tracy. That's really helpful.
So I'll just move on now and talk about the VAT exemption. So when I talk about the VAT exemption, what am I talking about? I'm talking about Group 1 of Schedule 9, the main provision to do with when land is exempt and subject to the option tax, or certain circumstances where it is automatically standard rated, like parking and various things in the list that's in Group 1. So what's been going on in relation to the VAT exemption this year? Well, the publication of notes is the call for evidence that was published in spring 2021. And that was about simplifying the VAT land exemption. Now, a call for evidence is not a consultation. It's sort of the step before where the revenue reach out to the industry and say, we're interested to hear your views on various things because we're thinking whether we should make changes or not to the legislation. Now, before the call for evidence a few years ago in 2017, there was an Office for Tax Simplification review and recommendation for simplification around VAT on the land exemption. And this call for evidence, it touches on the things that were thought about in the Office for Tax Simplification review. And it generally goes out to the industry and says, what can you give us your views as to what needs to be simplified? And they pose some ideas about removing the options tax, making things automatically standard rated and having an election to be exempt and such like. I think the observation really for this webinar is, what's going to come of that review, that call for evidence that has now closed. It's a watch this space. If the revenue do anything about it, sometimes they do with a call for evidence, sometimes they don't. And I question, is it really an issue with the rules needing simplifying, or are they actually well known and should be straightforward to apply in the first place? And is it actually the revenue pushing the boundaries potentially in some of the cases that they've brought that creates the complexity? Or is it the fact that the guidance doesn't follow certain trends within how property structures are carried out, and maybe it's the guidance that needs to be updated? Of course, any new system is itself going to bring complexity whilst people get used to it. So would an aim for simplicity actually create a period of complexity that isn't welcome in the market? So we will see where we get to and if we hear anything from the revenue. Now, that call for evidence only closed in August. And so I think it will be a while before we hear anything. But who knows? Today there may be something mentioned on it. So just moving on from that, and that point I said about the revenue pushing boundaries on the VAT exemption. Or moving the goalposts, I think, is probably a better way to describe it. I just thought I'd touch on three issues to do with the VAT exemption, just to see where we are now. So the first one is overages. Now, nothing has changed as far as I'm aware in relation to any case law on overages, but there was a concern over the last few years that there was a view held by the revenue that actually overages should be standard rated and shouldn't follow the supply that they originally related to. So they're not viewed as payment for the underlying supply of the land. Now, I, as far as I know, there is no guidance to suggest that. And actually, we're still in the status quo where, as advisors, we view overage payments as part of the consideration for the underlying supply of the land. So I think it's a watch this space point on overages. The key thing in practice is just to be aware of that change of law risk, because overages by their very nature are paid months or possibly years after the land transaction that's in question. And they will likely apply the VAT rules that apply at the time that the payment is actually made. Care is needed when you have maybe a zero rated supply on a transaction, which may often with a zero rated supply, the seller may accept a VAT inclusive position commercially. Now, if you accept a VAT inclusive position and it applies to the overage and then there is a change of law, the seller will then have to swallow the VAT that is charged. So be very careful of VAT inclusive wording in a contract where you've got an overage, and step back and reflect on whether that is appropriate to apply to the overage as well. So that's overages. Another area that was looked at was to do with call options. And we had the Land Links case in 2020, where the revenue argued that the call option wasn't a supply of land within the exemption in Group 1, and that it was automatically standard rated. Now, the revenue lost that argument and it was a surrender of a call option. They lost that argument in the first tier tribunal, and there's been no appeal. So what we have at the moment is guidance that still reflects that call options should fall within, or certainly doesn't say to the contrary, that call options should fall within Group 1. We have no binding precedent to say that it's anything different than that. And we have a first tier tribunal case that says that they didn't agree with the revenue and that it should fall within the exemption. So we are still with the status quo that we would have expected a few years ago anyway. And again, it is that change of law risk that advisors need to be aware of, and just be a little bit careful of maybe a challenge from the revenue that might try to push boundaries and say that the first tier tribunal case isn't binding and still try to challenge the interpretation. At the moment, the support is there for it, it's still falling within group one. And then finally, just a quick look at the option to tax anti-avoidance rules, because we had the Mousedale case, which got to the Scottish Court of Session in May 2021. Now, that the anti-avoidance rule is complicated, and actually this case was about the complications of applying the rules. So I'm not going to go into the detail of the rules, because we will be here, I could do a whole seminar on the anti-avoidance rules, but the it's a useful case to understand just the complexity of those rules. So it was to do with when an option to tax would be disapplied by the anti-avoidance rules, and typically those rules are trying to stop you recovering VAT or getting an early recovery of VAT, where ultimately the use of the building that the expenditure has been incurred in relation to is exempt. That's a huge generalisation, but that's where they're aimed at. And one of the myriad of tests that you have to look at looks at the intention of the transferee and whether or not the property would be a capital goods scheme item. Now, what happened with Mousedale was that you ended up in a circularity that if the option to tax was disapplied, then you wouldn't charge you wouldn't charge VAT, and then you got caught into a position that then actually said it shouldn't be disapplied, and then if you didn't disapply it, then you got caught into a position that said it would, and it went round in a circularity, as it's been described. And so it went through the first tier, the upper tier, and the Court of Session, and they all said that in the situation that you can't have that circularity, and the option to tax here, that the view was that it shouldn't be disapplied. Now, that is reflected in guidance, so VAT LP 23500, which talks about circularity, and it gives some examples, and that follows the case. And as far as I know, that guidance was issued during this process of the case going through the court. So if you followed the guidance, you're following the case, you're not doing anything wrong. I think what is interesting, though, from the case, and it's still possible that it could be appealed to the Supreme Court, is that it just shows how difficult those rules are to be applied in practice. And they're really difficult to apply. Sometimes they catch things they shouldn't do. Sometimes they cover things that wouldn't readily be in your mind when you're looking at a transaction. So I think from a practitioner's point of view, it's a case that reminds you of how important it is to be aware of the anti-avoidance rules, especially if you're the one making the supply, and to really scrutinise the application of those rules when you know that there is some exempt use of the building in relation to the transaction, or intended in relation to the building. What I would say is those rules are ripe for revision if someone had the cold towel they wanted to put on their head and start that journey.
Thanks, Tracy. Just before we move on, this might not be the easiest question to answer, but I wondered whether you think there might be wholesale reform or the need for it within the VAT rules relating to the VAT treatment of land.
My personal view, Alex, is that I would much rather see better guidance. Now, maybe that's because I'm a bit of a VAT dinosaur and I've been doing it for a number of years. I'm very comfortable with the rules as they stand. I think I would personally prefer the rules to stay and the guidance to be clearer. I think there are other advisors that feel the same, but clearly there are people who think that they should be simplified. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a call for evidence and the Office for Tax Simplification wouldn't be out there saying that the rules could be simplified. But I don't think there is a strong overriding view that the rules should need a wholesale reform. So that's enough for me for now. I'll hand over to Alex, who's going to pick up on the domestic reverse charge.
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Tracy. Yes, so I'm going to spend the next section of the talk discussing the domestic reverse charge and sale and leaseback transactions. So moving on to the slide discussing the domestic reverse charge. After a couple of years of delay, the domestic reverse charge has finally made its way into operation this year, March, in fact. Whilst broadly, I think the industry's experience would seem to have been positive, We've been advising clients on its implementation on several mandates this year. So this section of the webinar is intended really to be a refresher of the key points and concepts for practitioners when advising on the DRC. So what is the domestic reverse charge and what does it do? Essentially, it's a mechanism for the way in which VAT is paid and accounted for to HMRC for construction services. And that has changed so that now the recipient, not the supplier of construction services, is the one who's responsible for accounting for VAT to HMRC on those services. The changes are aimed at reducing instances in which VAT is being charged to customers and it not then accounted for to HMRC by the supplier of the services. So in effect, the DRC is and has been introduced as an anti-tax evasion rule rather than an anti-tax avoidance measure. Under the reverse charge procedure, the recipient of construction services, as long as they're not the end user, does not pay any VAT to the supplier of the services. Instead, the new procedure is that on the VAT return they send to HMRC, the recipient will be the one that accounts for the VAT to HMRC by way of the new domestic reverse charge. Recipients of such suppliers therefore need to make sure that they're not both subject to the domestic reverse charge and paying an amount in respect of VAT to their customers. The subcontractors need to account for the reverse charge and claim it back from HMRC at the same time, effectively cancelling out so no money is moved for those subcontractors. So what does that mean in the standard development contract situation? Well, the only party in the supply chain actually collecting any VAT is the main contractor, who will receive the services from the end user, who will receive the VAT from the end user. The main contractor then pays this over to HMRC, and it is the one that therefore is primarily responsible for VAT collection. Where services are partly subject to the domestic reverse charge and partly not subject to the domestic reverse charge, an apportionment should be made between the two. So it's appropriate and important to get accurate VAT invoicing and agree between the recipient and the supplier which services fall within the domestic reverse charge and which services don't. So I've already touched upon two concepts, which are end users and intermediaries, but what do we mean by those and how does that impact on the DRC? Well, the DRC, as I said, was a measure intended to apply to construction services supplied to other construction businesses. It's not intended to apply to construction services known to businesses known as end users. So those are ones that aren't primarily engaged in construction activities and ditto intermediaries. So where VAT is paid or by those entities, it will be paid as normal if services are supplied to businesses falling within those categories. So end users, these are taxable persons who use construction services for any purpose other than making supplies of construction services. HMRC have stated in their guidance that end users are not typically construction businesses. So some examples that we typically come across in practice are property owners, high street retailers, and property developers. They are all within the end user category. And additionally, we've got this another category that are not subject to the reverse charge, those intermediaries. So intermediaries are recipients who make onward supplies of construction services without materially altering or further processing the relevant service that's being provided. So there's no value add there. When we would typically look at the broader principles behind value-added tax. So the intermediary in these circumstances is either connected with the parent or subsidiary of the expected end user, or the supplies are made in relation to land, buildings, or even civil engineering works, in which both the intermediary and the expected end user of those services have relevant interests. A person has a relevant interest for these purposes if it's connected with the landlord or any other category of individual with an interest in the land, such that the land or buildings will be occupied by that relevant person. And intermediaries may refer to themselves as end users, and they may provide a statement to that effect, which broadly satisfies the requirements. And because those parties are connected or and use the construction services to supply an interest in property rather than supplying the construction services, they're regarded as falling in with the intermediaries category. So another point to note about the DRC that we've seen is its interlink with the construction industry scheme. So broadly, construction services for the purposes of the RAP reverse charge have been aligned with those services which are caught by the construction industry scheme. But the domestic reverse charge doesn't apply to all of them. So there are certain excluded services, such as professional services of architects, surveyors or consultants, that are excluded from the scope of the reverse charge, as they're and they are outside the scope. So that's all I really wanted to say about the DRC, unless you had any questions, Tracy.
I just had one, Alex. You mentioned that it was important for practitioners. Is it just a tax collection mechanism, or is it something which is relevant when drafting legal documents?
That's a very good question. I think the answer to that is that practitioners really do need to consider this when advising on a whole range of agreements. Particularly for us, it's those development agreements or JCT contract amendments that we often come across in practice. And additionally, it's very important that end users provide certificates or make declarations of their status in the relevant agreements to ensure that the reverse charge is administered correctly, and practitioners need to inquire with their clients at the earliest possible stage to make sure that they know whether their client is an end user, so as to provide the relevant declaration in the documentation. So yes, it's very important to draft appropriate provisions and agreements, and we're seeing that regularly in practice.
Thanks, Alex.
So moving on to the next topic and the next slide, this is sale and leaseback transactions, and I think this is perhaps the most important and the most interesting VAT development in the last 12 months. So there have been three recent decisions at all levels of the judicial system, which I think will be very important for practitioners when assessing VAT issues in this context, particularly in, say, the capital goods scheme area or the VAT self-supply charge on a change of use. So what were those cases? We had the CJEU decision in Midwell, which was actually prior to this year, but has framed the context of the later two cases and HMRC's recent guidance. So it's important that we discuss that to start off with. Then we had the Supreme Court decision in Bauhausi, which was after a long session of previous decisions in the Scottish courts up to the Court of Sessions. So we'll come on to discuss that. And then we had very, very recently, in the last couple of weeks, an unreported first tier decision in a case called A Blue. So the next section explores these questions in quite a bit of detail, these cases in quite a bit of detail, together with HMRC's interpretation of their implications in Revenue and Customs Brief 13/2021. So Midabel, depending how you pronounce it, it was a decision, as I said, which didn't happen in the last 12 months, but it was the first of these series of cases, and it came out when Bauhausi was going through the Court of Sessions or the lower Scottish tiers. So what happened in that case? Midabel's business was making potato-based products, and it was doing this in Belgium. It decided to enter into a sale and leaseback transaction over the buildings in which it was making these products with a view to financing its business and improving its liquidity. So it was a financing style sale and leaseback transaction. The Belgium tax authority sought to adjust input tax recovery for Midabel under similar rules to the UK capital goods scheme. And they said that was on the basis that the sale leg of the sale and leaseback constituted as an exempt supply for Belgium VAT purposes. So the CJEU looked at this and they said, well, the key question here was there one transaction, being the acquisition, and did anything really happen? Or was it correct to look at it as two separate transactions? And they found in favour of the taxpayer, and they said that there was a composite transaction such that the taxpayer did not have any input tax recovery adjustment under the equivalent CGS rules. So there was no gap in time between the sale and the lease back. And I suppose Brexit is important in this context. I wondered whether you saw that as well, Tracy.
Now, I was just wondering whether it still applies now we're in our post-Brexit period.
That's another good question. And I think yes is the answer. That's actually it's quite a simple one, this one. It's because Maida Bell came out prior to the UK's exit. Its binding authority on the UK courts. And that was a point that was borne out in Lady Arden's concurring but separate judgment in the Balhousie case, which I'm just about to come on to, that she thought that the UK courts were obliged to follow that CJEU decision. So moving on to the next slide, here, I just wanted to set out what Balhousie involved, and I think I'll start with just discussing the background and the facts behind the case. So the critical question facing the Supreme Court here was whether a sale and lease back should be viewed as a single transaction again or two separate transactions for VAT purposes. And this affected the application of the self-supply charge. So the Court of Sessions in Scotland obviously had that CJEU decision in the back of their mind, and they thought about it, and that was the basis on which they decided the case in Scotland. But the Supreme Court took a little slightly different angle on that. So what were the facts in Balhousie? There was a care home that had been acquired by an entity called BCL. In 2013 from another company in the wider Balhousie group. That's the corporate group, not the VAT group. And in order to finance that acquisition, BCL entered into a sale and lease back with an entity called Target Healthcare REIT. And there was an intra-group supply of a sale and lease back between Balhousie group members. And therefore, they said, well, the zero rating applied under Group 5 of Item 1 of Schedule 8 of the Value Added Tax Act. So the sale and lease back with Target Healthcare took place, and BCL continued to operate that care home business. HMRC came along and said, well, there's a self-supply charge here, potentially, under what is really an anti-avoidance rule. And the benefit of a zero-rated supply can be clawed back in those circumstances from the recipient of that supply if one of two different conditions are met, and they're found in part two of Schedule 10 of the value added tax, where within 10 years of the disposal, the recipient either disposes of its entire interest in the building or changes the use of the building from a qualifying to a non-qualifying use. And it's the first of those circumstances which may have been brought about by the sale and lease back, and that's what HMRC were arguing in the Balhousie case. And then they said, well, yes, then it would be, if that applied, then the VAT self-supply charge would apply. So the critical question for the Supreme Court, and it was the key question, was the entire interest of the property being disposed of? And that's how they framed the judgment. So in the leading judgment, which was given by Lord Briggs, he said that the key question was not the composite or two single transactions question. It was this question to do with whether the entire interest of the property had been disposed of. And as the sale and lease back occurred simultaneously, there was no period when BCL had disposed of its entire interest in the property. So on that basis, he sidestepped the Maida Bell decision. And he said it wasn't directly relevant, but that's not the position that Lady Arden took when she was giving her concurring opinion, but for different reasons. She said that Maida Bell should be applied on the facts, and that the CJEU decision meant that a sale and lease back for financing purposes should be viewed as a single transaction in the VAT context. But really, that's not the end of the story, even though the taxpayer won in that case. There have been a couple of recent developments that I think it would be important to discuss, and these have only really just happened in the last couple of weeks. So the first of those is Revenue and Customs Brief 13/2021. And HMRC have now provided their views as to what the Bauhaus decision means in practice for them and how they will view sale and leaseback transactions going forwards. So they say that there are certain criteria that must be met in order for a disposal of the entire interest in the property not to have taken place. So the first is that a qualifying property must have been purchased. When the property is sold, there must be an immediate lease in place, which is a seamless transaction and no lapse in time. And then a key and very important one, the lease must be for the remaining term of the 10 years, for 10 years from the original purchase date or longer. So it's at least 10 years the lease mark must be granted for. The property must continually be used or operated for a qualifying purpose, meaning the business suffers no break or in trade during the sale and leaseback. So I think there's a bit of scope for debate here as to whether the revenue and custom brief correctly implements the decision in the Supreme Court of Bauhaus. In particular, that 10-year requirement wasn't there, didn't appear anywhere in the judgment. But I think for practitioners, when we encounter financing-based sale and leaseback transactions, typically the leaseback is for a greater period than 10 years. So it would be quite an unusual situation where that requirement isn't met. But it's certainly one to remember if you're looking at a sale and leaseback going forward. But that isn't actually quite it either. There was another decision of the first tier this time, again involving a sale and leaseback, actually, or more accurately, a lease and leaseback. And that was the A Blue case. And this was unreported in the last couple of weeks. So here the taxpayer acquired by assignment a long leasehold in a building, similar sort of scenario to some of the previous ones, and immediately granted a lease back of a lease and leaseback for a peppercorn rent for a slightly less term than the superior lease that had been acquired for the commercial part of the building. The taxpayer paid VAT on its acquisition and claimed full impact tax recovery. This was actually what's known as a title sale and leaseback, or formerly known as a title sale and leaseback, rather than a financing-based transaction, as the purpose was, I think, to tidy up the legal ownership of the property for conveyancing-based reasons in order to, for the long leaseholder to pursue a development or something similar over the site. So HMRC came along and argued that because no rent was actually arising on the leaseback, this was a non-business activity for that purposes, and they disallowed input tax recovery on the 65% of the acquisition costs that related to the commercial element that has been subject to this transaction. The first tier had a review, and effectively they just applied Midabel. They said that it was a composite transaction, nothing had happened for VAT purposes, there was no gap in time, and therefore the taxpayer was entitled to full recovery. So HMRC lost there. I think it's a case of watch this space to see whether anything further comes out of this. I can't believe this will be the end of the story. I think there will be further cases in this area. And that's about all I wanted to say about sales and leasebacks. Unless you've got any other questions, Tracy.
No, I don't. That was great, Alex. So I don't have any questions on that area. I'll just touch on one final thing then at the end of this webinar. Carrying on the care home theme, we just thought it would be interesting to touch on a recent care home case, first tier case called Silver Sea Properties. I think just it's interesting because Bauhaus was a care home case. The reason for picking on this one is really just to highlight that care homes actually bring out a lot of the VAT rule complexities. And so as for practitioners, they really do need to bear that in mind when you are advising in relation to care homes, because that it's ripe for getting the VAT treatment, for needing to look at the VAT treatment quite carefully. And care homes are now becoming institutional assets. So they are being dealt but purchased and developed by different parties, and they might have been a few years ago. So just to quickly touch on this case, it was a case that had a what's known as a PropCo-OpCo structure. So where the property was developed in one company and through a desire to operate it out of another company, when it was practically complete, a lease was granted to an operating entity. And where in the residential sector, so with care homes, if it's the first grant of a major interest by the person constructing, that lease is typically zero rated. So you need a lease of more than 21 years. And that's what happened here. It was a 25-year lease. And there was no, the case was not about the zero rating. That was accepted. What the case was about was the VAT treatment of the furniture, fixtures and equipment within that structure. And there were two points. One was about the scope of the VAT blocking order, and one was to do with the actual zero rated supply and whether it was a single composite supply of everything that was viewed as supplied under the lease. We don't have a huge amount of time, so I won't go into the detail of the blocking order, but it's useful to just note that the case has some is worth a read if you are advising on the impact of the blocking order. So the blocking order, which is a statutory instrument that provides it's 1992 statutory instrument 3222, and what it says is so that the VAT rules say that if you have building materials that are incorporated in a building, then they follow the supply of the construction services, that you know they're viewed as part of the construction supply. But if they are incorporated in the building, but they're not building materials, then the VAT treatment looks at them differently. And there is a particular what the blocking order says is if you have a zero rated supply, which is a taxable supply and would normally give you the right to recover your input tax, you are blocked from recovering the input tax on non-building materials incorporated into your building. And you often hear about the white goods blocking order, and that's what it is. But it goes much further than washing machines being plumbed into a building. But that's where the concept of white goods comes from. So if the case has some interesting discussion around that and has an interesting analysis linked to that, you'll probably remember the Taylor Wimpey case from a few years ago. So if you're advising in that area, the Taylor Wimpey case is still a point of reference, and this case will be a useful point of reference as well, albeit it's first tier. The other point, which is probably the one I wanted to just flag a bit more, was that the single composite supply argument. So here we had the lease of a building that was zero rated, but the discussion was about the treatment of the loose goods and whether on and the output tax treatment of those loose goods, because it wasn't just a building that was leased. There was furniture, there were consumables, crockery, J cloths. I say J cloths because they're mentioned in the case, that the facts take pages of the case to actually sort of determine. And the arguments in the case were that they were all supplied under the terms of the lease and they should all be viewed as a single composite supply and a zero rated supply. But the first tier tribunal said, no, that isn't the case. They said the fact that an item is within the scope of a lease rather than separate to a separate charge doesn't necessarily make that item a single composite supply. They said the fact that there is something very, there's something very odd in the notion that an item which can be used once, like a plaster, or has a very limited life, for example, the J cloths, could be rented for a 25-year term. And so they didn't agree that there was a single composite supply. Now, what they didn't do was then say how it would all be apportioned. They sent that back to the parties to decide. Now, this one is slightly interesting on its facts. And if you take away the crockery and those things and look at what might typically be part of a lease within a PropCo-OpCo structure and a building of this nature, you may well have loose furniture in a communal area, for example. That's quite common. And I think what this case highlights is you've got to be really careful about the VAT treatment of that loose furniture. It's a logic that a washing machine has its VAT blocked because ultimately it's being used by the end consumer. Like somebody who would buy it and put it in their house themselves, then you can see that logic applying to loose furniture as well. But the blocking order doesn't apply because we're talking about loose items. I certainly work on the basis that VAT on loose items is unlikely to be recoverable in a zero rating concept. And this case suggests the same. Now, how it's actually treated and the mechanics of it is actually quite an interesting point and one that needs more thought. So it may be that you would on supply that furniture at cost to the OpCo, and then typically the OpCo wouldn't be able to recover the VAT because they in the resi sector, they're typically having exempt supplies of resi ASTs or the equivalent, or you may say, okay, we're just not going to recover the VAT on the furniture in the first place, and there is no rent allocated to the furniture, and there's no deemed supply because we haven't recovered any VAT in the first place. So, however you deal with it, and actually that needs quite a lot of thought, and we don't really have time to explore that here. I think the message is, don't assume that just because something is written into the lease that it can form part of the zero rated supply, and particularly loose items that won't last the journey of the 25 years or whatever it is as the length of the lease.
Just very, very quickly, I wondered whether this case had wider implications outside the care home industry.
Yeah, I mean, it does, Alex. When I read this case, I was instantly thinking about build-to-rent transactions as well. So I think this case, this care home case, has the interesting added thing that the extras, those consumables that were there, that were they're very specific, I think, to care homes. But if you think of build-to-rent structures, which are residential properties that are built for the rental market, you often have these PropCo-OpCo structures, and you often have communal areas that will have furniture in them and may well be provided by the PropCo to the OpCo or part of your transaction document. So yes, I do think they have wider application, and anyone dealing with this concept of PropCo-OpCo structures and zero rated leasing should take note.
Thanks, Tracy.
Right, well, I think that's us done for this webinar. We've not covered everything that's happened with VAT and property in 2021, but we've picked out some things that we think might be useful for you. And we hope you've enjoyed the hour of the webinar. Thanks ever so much.